Good morning once again. So, as you know, I'm the youth advisor of the church, and with the youth group, as they discussed what to do for the 2012 youth service, Rose and Thomas remembered that their siblings had done a service on Theodore Parker back in 2006. And they thought that in the year of the 300th anniversary of our church, it might be appropriate to do this again. And along the way, they and you might learn a little bit more about Theodore Parker. And it also seemed like a fun thing to do, as you will see. So back in 2006, I'd remembered that our beloved former minister Bob Haney had written something about Parker that had been performed during a service some time ago by members of the congregation. So I searched my old files to see if I could find it, and I came across a yellowed copy together with an order of service that was dated June 7th, 1987. So the performance today, a slightly shortened version that the youth of 2006 created, will be the 25th anniversary of its premiere, almost to the day. At the youth group meetings in the winter, we read Bob's manuscript, and this is the 2006 group, and shortened it a bit, and this group will now present it to you. And I'm going to introduce it with the words of Bob Haney, slightly modified for today. You'll see the modifications. It was nearly 175 years ago, on June 21st, 1837, that this church, then known as the Second Parish in Roxbury, ordained Parker and installed him as its seventh minister. To remember him, it will all do us good to hear some of his words. To begin to understand him, we shall all profit from hearing how others responded to him. And so Bob Haney conspired to present a portrait of Parker in his own words and in those of people who knew him. We don't pretend to be creating a great theatrical production. We do invite you to listen to a variety of voices and to hear in their words, at least from time to time, something worthy of your consideration. So to join me in this celebration, I introduce you members of the youth group in new roles. And can you each stand up as I say it? The voice of Theodore Parker will be that of Thomas Colgrove. In 2006, it was his sister Caitlin. And in 1987, I played the role. We turn to Griffin Lane for the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson. In 2006, it was Colin Swanson, and in 1987, the role was played by Doug Armstrong. In the voice of Sheila Jacobson, we shall be listening to Elizabeth Peabody. In 2006, it was Lynn Glogley, and in 1987, it was Carol Thomas that played that role. Griffin will also be for us James Russell Lowell. Meredith Richmond played the part in 2006, and in 1987 it was the late Albert Washington. We turn to Sarah Armstrong for the words of Margaret Fuller. In 2006 it was Meredith Glogley, and in 1987 it was Carol Thomas again. We by then were a small congregation, didn't we? And the voice of Louisa May Alcott will come to us thanks to Hallie Armstrong. In 2006, it was Julia Glogley, and in 1987, the part was played by Anne Forsyth. These voices will come to you from the pulpit. From this podium, Rose will be reading Bob Haney's narration. And for those who remember Bob, you will, I'm sure, hear his words in her voice. So the youth group presents a celebration of Theodore Parker by Bob Haney.
I keep in my study two trophies of the American Revolution. One is a musket, which my grandfather fought with at the Battle of Lexington, against the British. The other is a great gun which he captured in that battle. He was the captain of the Lexington soldiers and took the first prisoner and the first musket taken in the War for Independence and the Rights of Man. But now I'm obliged to look to the British for protection for the liberty of two of my own parishioners who have committed no wrong against anyone. Well, so it is. And I thank God that old England, with all her sins and shames, allows no slave hunter to set foot on her soil.
Thus did Theodore Parker write to the British Unitarian clergyman, James Martineau, in 1850, concerning two fugitive slaves whom Parker had helped to find freedom in Great Britain. Whatever ironies the situation might imply, Parker was not a man to succumb to any notion of the human tragedy. He believed instead that good intentions had merely been thwarted for the time being, and that the rights of humankind would triumph sooner rather than later, as they must.
On the longest day of 1837, I was ordained minister of the Unitarian Church and congregation at West Roxbury, a little village near Boston, and one of the smallest societies in New England, where I found men and women whose friendship is still dear and instructive. For the first year or two, the congregation did not exceed 70 persons, including the children. I soon became well acquainted with all in the little parish, and I found some men of rare enlightenment, some truly noble and generous souls. I knew the characters of all, and the thoughts of such as had them. I took great pains. I took great pains with the composition of my sermons. They were never out of my mind. I had an intense delight in writing and in preaching, but I was a learner quite as much as a teacher, and was feeling my way forward and upward with one hand while I tried to lead men with the other. I preached natural laws, nothing on the authority of any church, any tradition, any sect, though I sought illustration and confirmation from all of these sources. For historical things, I looked to historical evidence. For spiritual things, I found ready proof in the primal instincts of the soul, the confirmation in the life of religious men. The simple life of the farmers, mechanics, milkmen, farmers about me, of its own accord, they turned into a sort of poetry and reappeared in the sermons, as the green woods, not far off, looked into the windows of the meeting house. I think I preached only what I had experienced in my own inward consciousness, which widened and grew richer as I came into practical contact with living men, turning time into life, and mere thought became character.
In the pastoral setting of West Roxbury, the seeds of later controversies slowly germinated, as Parker dealt with the practical problems of a parish parson and began to examine the moral issues of his time. In his later preaching, he aimed his sermonic bow at injustices, hypocrisies, and greed of his age. And, for the most part, his arrows struck their mark at the bullseye. But his earlier sermons at West Roxbury, calmer, more pastoral, less polemical, dealt with more universal themes. Some of them could still be of value to us, such as his sermon, Tranquility, which contains these lines.
The present age is marked by restless activity. Ours is an age of little enterprises, which every man undertakes by himself and carries fiercely onward. There is no rest. All is full of outward life. Commerce has multiplied her wings. Nothing is good enough. What satisfied our fathers, men of stout hearts, only excites our contempt. We will change all that, is the cry. Onward, without stop, is the index of the present day. Amid many virtues, never before called out, there is one crying fault which shows itself everywhere. I scarcely need say that this fault is restlessness, a want of calmness and tranquility. it belongs eminently to our times. There has not been an age since the great flood where men were so restless, so foreign to all spirit of calmness and tranquility. The spirit of tranquility is the spirit of strength. This is abundantly shown in the works of nature. All the great words in the wide world are done without noise or tumult. God's spirit, everywhere active, is nowhere noisy. All over the world, great matters are passing to completeness. There is the mark of the restless power going quietly to work, never fearing to come short of its object, and so without haste. The earth traverses her course with a mighty speed, yet so quiet withal that the sleeping infant is not disturbed, nor an insect jostled from his perch. Silently and slowly, the oak comes forth from the dark ground, inch by inch, year after year, century in, century out. It grows silently while men sleep, till at last it stands a firm pillar, upright and strong. The calmness of nature is beautiful. It should sink into the heart of man, teaching him a lesson of composure and tranquility.
In the middle of July, in the year of 1838, Ralph Waldo Emerson journeyed from his home in Concord to Cambridge. The graduating class of the Harvard Divinity School had invited him to speak about what it means to be a minister. Theirs was a curious choice, for Emerson had been, for some time, in the process of withdrawing from the active ministry. Emerson had made sure some of his Boston friends would be present. Theodore Parker was there, as were Elizabeth Palmer Peabody and James Freeman Clark. Emerson said much to unsettle his listeners. Toward the end of his address, he proclaimed,
"It is the office of a true teacher to show that God is, not was, that he speaketh, not spake. The true Christianity, a faith like Christ's, in the infinitude of man, is lost. None believeth in the soul of man, but only in some man or person old and departed. Ah me, no man goeth alone. All men go in flocks to this saint or that poet, avoiding the God who seeth in secret. They cannot see in secret. They love to be blind in public."
Emerson's words may well have helped Parker and many others to refocus their thoughts. His address surely distressed many in his audience. "I did not like it at all," wrote Edward Everett Hale. "Mr. Emerson held that the Christianity of the present day is little better than none, that churchgoing was less popular than formerly, owing to the bad preaching of the ministers of the day, whom he rated severely as not putting enough of self into their sermons." Individual members of the faculty of Harvard Divinity School sought to put as much distance as possible between themselves and the disagreeable guest from Concord. They objected to Emerson's taste for thinking about God in terms of timeless cosmic laws rather than as a creator and comforter. They were dismayed that he had cavalierly dismissed the importance of miracles for Christianity. Theodore Parker had joined the battle at Emerson's side, first by writing an anonymous pamphlet, which few people read, and in 1841, by preaching an ordination sermon entitled "The Transient and Permanent in Christianity." The sermon created an even greater controversy than had Emerson's address.
"Looking at the word of Jesus, at real Christianity, the pure religion he taught, nothing appears more fixed and certain. Its influence widens as light extends. It deepens as the nations grow more wise. But looking at the history of what men call Christianity, nothing seems more uncertain and perishable. While true religion is always the same, in every century, in every land, in each man that feels it, the Christianity of the pulpit, which is the religion taught, and the Christianity of the people, which is the religion that is accepted and lived out, has never been the same thing in any two centuries or lands, except only in name. It must be confessed, though with sorrow, that transient things form a great part of what is commonly taught as religion. An undue place has often been assigned to forms and doctrines, while too little stress has been laid on the divine life of the soul, love to God, and love to man. Real Christianity gives men new life. It is the growth and the perfect action of the Holy Spirit that God puts into the sons of men. It makes us outgrow any form or any system of doctrines we have devised and approach still closer to the truth. It would make the Bible our servant, not our master. It would make us revere the holy word spoken by godly men of old, but revere still more the word of God spoken through conscience, reason, and faith as the holiest of all. It would not make Christ the despot of the soul, but the brother of all men. It would point to him as our brother who went before like the good shepherd to charm us with the music of his words and with the beauty of his life to tempt us up to the steps of mortal toil within the gates of heaven. It would lead us to form Christ in the heart and work out our salvation by this. For it is not so much by the Christ who lived so blameless and so beautiful 18 centuries ago that we are saved directly, but by the Christ we form in our hearts and live in our daily life that we save ourselves, God working with us both to will and to do.
The ensuing battle over Parker's sermon was initiated by some Orthodox ministers who rushed into print, calling Parker an infidel, a scorner, and a blasphemer, and who asked the Boston Unitarian clergy whether they thought Parker to be a Christian minister. Either by word or deed, most of the local Unitarian clergy disavowed Parker and turned their backs to him, refusing all pulpit exchanges with him. Some pressure was even placed upon Parker's West Roxbury congregation to dismiss him. Writing to the minister at Northampton, who had just resigned from his church, Elizabeth Palmer Peabody described the situation in Boston.
"I could fill you a page about Parker, who goes on with the rapidity of an angel, improving and unfolding and making a prodigious impression on people in spite of clerical opposition and the meanest of tricks. He grows deeper and tendered as he grows bolder and more radical, and it seems to me that he looks more and more like the pictures of the old saints. I hardly know so affecting a sight as he is in prayer. Sophia Ripley said the other day that one felt how much he suffered whenever he poured himself in prayer. It is a living evidence of living communion and always produces a great impression. His sermon at South Boston was a consuming fire. I heard it. But it is palpable to everybody how many of the ministers dread his coming, while the common people hear him gladly. His people at Spring Street are very faithful, and they are constantly gratified and supported by the evidences of interest in him in the country round. I have just returned from Thursday lecture and read an article proposing to indict Mr. Parker for blasphemy before the grand jury."
Nothing came of that proposal, but as the storms of controversy broke over Parker's head, some of his friends wished that he could cool his disputatious spirit. Margaret Fuller, never one of Parker's warmest admirers, observed,
"Parker's outlook is wide, but it will not deepen unless his fount of inward knowledge should deepen. He is still, I hear, too polemical in his tone. Truth needs no such weapons. However, those who use them do disturb the waters. till perchance an angel may be tempted down to still and better to purify them.
Her reference to an angel led Miss Fuller to think at once of Ralph Waldo Emerson, and she noted that he was then lecturing in Philadelphia, Baltimore, and New York. Emerson recorded in his journal some of his own reactions to Parker and his problems.
I observe that all bookish men have a tendency to believe they are unpopular. Parker gravely informs me by word and letter that he is precisely the most unpopular of all men in New England. Bronson Alcott believed the same thing of himself, and I, no doubt, if they had not anticipated me in claiming this distinction, should have claimed it for myself.
Another observer of the Boston scene adopted an even more jocular approach to the squabblings of the Unitarians. In his Fable for Critics, the young James Russell Lowell had a little poetical fun with Parker and his foes.
Here comes Parker, the Orson of Parsons, a man whom the church undertook to put under her ban. They believe, faith, I'm puzzled, I think I may call their believing a believing in nothing at all, or something of that sort. I know they all went for a total union of total dissent. He went a step further without cough or hem, and frankly avowed he believed not in them. And before he could be jumbled up or prevented from their orthodox kind of dissent, he dissented. So they first read him out of their church, and the next minute turned round and declared he had never been in it. But the band was too small, or the man was too big, for he recks not their bells, books, or candles a fig. He bangs and bethwacks them, their backs he salutes, with the whole tree of knowledge torn out by the roots. Every word that he speaks has been fierily furnished, in the blast of a life that has struggled in earnest. And there he stands, looking more like a plowman than priest, if not dreadfully awkward, not graceful at least. His gestures all downright and same, if you will, as of brown-fisted hobnail and hoeing a drill, but his periods fall on you, stroke after stroke, like the blows of a lumberer felling an oak. You forget the man wholly. You're thankful to meet with a preacher who smacks of the field and the street.
The effects of Parker's critics to silence him backfired. A small group of Boston businessmen decided that if no downtown Boston church would invite Parker to preach, then a church would have to be created for him. With the approval of his West Roxbury church, Parker began to divide his time between his old friends on Spring Street and the 1,500 people who gathered to hear him at the Melodeon Theater on Washington Street. The Melodeon congregation became incorporated as a church in November 1845. In the following year, Parker resigned his West Roxbury pastorate. Outgrowing its space, the new church moved into an even newer music hall in 1852, located several blocks away on Winter Street. During his years at the Melodeon and the music hall, Parker hurled himself into controversies concerning social reform. He spoke out against slavery and physically opposed the fugitive slave law. He condemned the plight of the poor and the conditions in prisons. That Theodore Parker profoundly affected many of those who heard him is amply attested by their recollections long after the event. Even his prayers deeply moved some of those who came to worship with him. Here are the memories of Louisa May Alcott.
The first time I heard Theodore Parker preach was a memorable day to me, as such occasions doubtless were to many others who came to wonder and remained to pray. The sermon was addressed to laborious young women and was full of paternal advice, encouragement, and sympathy. But the prayer that followed went straight to the hearts of those for whom he prayed, not only comforting by its tenderness and strengthening by its brave and cheerful spirit, but showing them where to go for greater help and how to ask it as simply and confidingly as he did. It was unlike any prayer I had ever heard. Not cold and formal, as if uttered from a sense of duty, not a display of eloquence, nor an impious directing of deity in his duties toward humanity. It was a quiet talk with God, as if long intercourse and much love had made it natural and easy for the Son to seek the Father, confessing faults, asking help, and submitting all things to the all-wise and tender, as freely as children bringing their little sorrows, hopes, and fears to their mother's knee. The slow, soft folding of the hands, the reverent bowing of the good gray head, the tears that sometimes veiled the voice, the simplicity, frankness, and devout earnestness made both words and manner wonderfully eloquent, and the phrase, "Our Father and our Mother God," was inexpressibly sweet and beautiful, seeming to involve both power and love to sustain and comfort the anxious, overburdened hearts of those who listened and went away to labor and to wait with fresh hope and faith.
In 1856, there was a great revival of Orthodox Christianity. Its advocates hastened to condemn Parker. "Hell never vomited forth a more blasphemous monster than Theodore Parker," declared one evangelist. Speaking of the message of Orthodox Christianity, Parker responded with words that have not lost their efficacy nor their appropriateness.
"What an idea of God is offered to man. Can anyone love such a God? I do not wonder why men and women go mad. The idea of Christ, what blasphemy against that noble man who said religion is love of God and love of man. What an idea of religion here and of heaven hereafter. My friends, piety is not delirium. The churches need a revival. No institution in America is more corrupt than her churches. No 30,000 men and women are so bigoted and narrow as the 30,000 ministers. The churches, they are astern of all other craft that keep the intellectual sea. The people mean a revival of religion, but the ministers will turn it into a revival of ecclesiastic theology, the doctrine of the Dark Ages, which we ought to have left behind us centuries ago."
"I am 47 by the reckoning of my mother, 74 by my own internal count. I am an old man." And indeed, by 1857, so he had become. A predisposition to tuberculosis had long troubled him. An extended struggle against pleurisy weakened him further. He refused to take care of himself. There was always so much to be done, and he was ever a man to honor the full weight of his duties. When the seriousness of his condition could no longer be denied, he reluctantly undertook a trip to the West Indies, where he composed a 40,000-word letter to his congregation. From there, he journeyed to Italy. Realizing that the end was near, he chose not to die in Rome, which symbolized so much that he had long opposed. And so he sought haven in Florence, and there he died at the age of 49.
Theodore Parker has filled up all his years and days and hours. A son of the energy of New England, restless, eager, manly, brave, early old, contumacious, clever, I can well praise him at a spectator's distance, for our minds and methods were unlike, few people more unlike. He was willing to perish in the using. He sacrificed the future for the present, was willing to spend and be spent, felt himself to belong to the day he lived in, and he too much to do than he should be careful for fame. He used every day, hour, minute. He lived in the latest moment, and his character appeared in the last moments with the same firm control as in the day of strength.
I Emerson's summation of Parker's life is echoed by Louisa May Alcott, for whom a visit to Parker's grave provides a tableau of signs and symbols.
Standing by his grave in Florence, it seemed at first a lonely and forlorn spot for such an honored dust to lie in. But as we looked, we found that many pilgrims had worn a path to this shrine, that other hands had brought fresh offerings, and in the myrtle that spread its green coverlet over the low bed, a little bird had built its nest, as if sure of a refuge there, although the hospitable heart lay still below. Finding comfort in these signs and symbols, we dropped our flowers, poor gifts for the greatest help one human soul can give another, and went away, feeling that in neither Florence nor Rome should we find anything more beautiful or grand than the life of one who loved his neighbor better than himself and prayed for all men as his brothers.
In June 1987, the Reverend Robert Haney wrote these words: "Of all the tributes that Theodore Parker received in life and in death, among all the testaments of affection that have gathered around his name, my personal favorite is this one. It comes from a resolution adopted by the people of the Second Church of Roxbury, now known as the Theodore Parker Church in West Roxbury, on January 30th, 1846, upon the occasion of Parker's resignation. We have gathered around him when the world forsook him, when his brethren were cold and no word of kindly encouragement met him on right or on the left. This little society, few in numbers, inconsiderable in influence, limited in resources, and solitary in independence, did not shrink from bearing its testimony in his days of trial. It has stood by him through good and evil report with the resolution and unanimity that has sustained by the conviction that God will uphold the right, that what of truth was uttered would live and what of error would pass away. The bond which has held us together can never be forgotten by him or by us." From the light of days remembered burns a beacon bright and clear, guiding hands and hearts and spirits into faith set free from fear. Please rise as you are able and join us and Michael in singing the closing hymn number 1028 in this hymnal.